Chapter 4. Toulon. The Mistral had died away at last, and there was scarcely a fleck of white left on the sea. But the brilliant clarity of the air was still undimmed, so that a telescope from the hills behind the town could pick out even the names of the 7 line-of-battle ships in the Petit Rade. The Formidable and Indomptable, both of 80 guns, and the Atlas, Scipion, Intrépide, Mont Blanc, and Berwick of 74 apiece. English pride might have been hurt at the sight of the last, for she belonged to the Royal Navy until some years before, and had English pride been able to look into the jealously guarded arsenal, it would have been mortified again by seeing 2 more British 74s. The Hannibal, captured during Sir James Samora's action in the Gut of Gibraltar in 1801, and the Swiftsure, taken in the Mediterranean a few weeks earlier, both of them under active repair. Indeed, activity, extreme activity, was the word for Toulon. The silent, still green hills, the great headlands, the enormous sweep of the Mediterranean beyond them, and the islands, blue and motionless beyond expression, the flood of hot, oppressive light, and then, in the middle, this noisy little stirring concentrated town filled with tiny figures, white shirts, blue trousers, the gleam of red sashes, all of them intensely busy. Even under this noonday sun they were toiling like ants, boats pulling from the arsenal to the Petite Rade, from the Petite Rade to the Grande Rade, from the ships to the quays and back again, men swarming over the fine great ships on the stocks, plying their adzes, caulking hammers, augers, beetles, herring poles, gangs of convicts unloading oak from Ragusa, Stockholm tar, Hamburg tow, Riga spars and cordage, all the din and the innumerable smells of a great port, the reek of open drains, old stagnant water, hot stone, frying garlic, grilling fish that wafted above the whole. "Dinner," said Captain Christy Palliere, closing the file of death sentences F through L. "I shall start with a glass of bagnoles and some anchovies, a handful of olives, black olives. Then I believe I may look at Hébert's fish soup and follow it with a simple langouste and corbillon. Possibly gigot en croûte. The lamb is exquisite now that the thyme is in flower. Then no more than cheese, strawberries and some trifle with our coffee. A saucer of my English jam, for example. None of your architectural meals, Penouet. My liver will not stand it in this heat, and we have a great deal of work to do if the animal is to be ready for sea by next week. There are all de Manois' dossiers to deal with. How I wish he would come back. I should have interrogated the Maltese this morning. If we have a good dinner, they risk to escape unshot. Let us drink tavel with the lamb," said Captain Penouet, who knew that for his part he risked philosophical remarks about digestion, guilt, Pontius Pilate, the odious side of interrogating suspected spies, quite unfit for officers, if he did not interrupt. "It is 2 roast beefs to see you, sir," said an orderly. "Oh, no," cried Captain Christy Palliere. "Not at this hour. Holy name, tell them I'm not here, you know. I may be back at 5. Who are they?" "The first is Aubrey, Jacques. He claims to be a captain in their navy," said the orderly, narrowing his eyes and scanning the official slip in his hand. "Born 1st of April, 1066, at Bedlam, London. Father's profession monk, mother's nun, mother's maiden name Borgia Lucrèce. The other pilgrim is Mathurin Etienne." "Quick, quick!" cried Captain Christy Palliere. "My breeches, you know, my cravat!" For ease and commodity he'd been sitting in his drawers. "Son of a whore, my shirt, Penouet! We must have a real dinner tonight. Find a clothes brush, you know. This is the English prisoner I was telling you about. Excellent seaman. Charming company. You will not mind speaking English, of course. How do I look?" "So pimping as possible," said Captain Pennaway in that language. Camber de Torso, and you will impose yourself of their attention. Show them in, Jeannot, said Christie Palliere. My dear Aubrey, he cried, folding Jack in his arms and kissing him on both cheeks. How very happy I am to see you, dear Dr. Maturin. Be the very welcome. Allow me to present Captain of Frigate Pennaway, Captain of Frigate Aubrey, and Dr. Maturin, at one time my guests aboard the Desay. Your servant, sir, said Captain Pennaway. Domestic, monsieur, said Jack, still blushing as far as his shirt. Pennaway? Je préserve, j'ai le plus vivid remembrance de vous combattre à Ushant à bord le pont, en 24-9. A second of attentive, polite, but total blankness followed this, and turning to Christine Palliere, he said, How do you say I have the liveliest recollection of Captain Pennaway's gallant action off Ushant in 99? Captain Christie Palliere said this in another kind of French. Renewed, far warmer smiles, another British shake hand, and observed, But we may all speak English. My colleague is one of our best translators. Come, let us go and have dinner in a trice. You are tired, dusty, quite fagged up. How far have you come today? How do you stand the heat? Extraordinary for the month of May. Have you seen my cousins in Bath? May we hope for your company for some time? How happy I am to see you. We had hoped you'd dine with us, cried Jack. We have livre en table, booked it. You are in my country, said Christie Palliere, in a tone that allowed of no reply. After you, dear friends, I beg. A simple meal, a little inn just outside the town, but it has muscatrellis. Fresh air, and the man does the cooking himself. Turning to Stephen as he shepherded them along the corridor, he said, Dr. Ramy is with us again. He came back from leave on Tuesday. I will ask him to come and sit with us after dinner. He could not bear to see us eat. And he will tell you all the news of our cholera outburst and the new Egyptian pox. Captain Aubrey led us such a chase, he said to Captain Pennaway, setting pieces of bread to represent the ships of Admiral Linois' squadron. He commanded that little quarter-deck brig, the Sophie. I remember myself of him. And at first he had the weather gauge of us, but he was embayed. Here is the headland, and the wind was so, a caprice wind. He fought the battle over again, stage by stage. And then he put up his helm in a flash, set his studding sails like a conjuring trick, and ran through our line close to the Admiral. The Fox, he knew I dared not risk hitting the flagship, and he knew that they say his broadside would come rather slow. He ran through, and with a little luck... What is luck? Chance. He might have escaped. But the Admiral made my signal to chase, and the Desay was only a week out of dock quite clean, and she loves a light breeze on the quarter. And in short, I should have blown you out of the sea with my last broadside, dear friend, if you had not jugged like a hare. Well, I remember it, said Jack. My heart was in my boots as I saw you beginning to luff up. But it had gone down there much earlier when I saw that you sailed 2 miles to my one without troubling to set your stunsails. It was an exploit of thunder to run through the line, said Captain Pennaway. I could almost to wish you had succeeded the blow. I should have struck as soon as the Admiral had forereached my ship. But, in principle, you English carry too many guns, is it not? Too many for sail fast in such breeze, too many to escape oneself. I tossed mine all overboard, said Jack, though in principle you're right. Yet might we not say that in principle you carry far too many men, particularly soldiers? Remember the Phoebe and Africaine? The simple meal wound to its even simpler end. A bottle of brandy and 2 glasses. Captain Penaway, exhausted by his efforts, had returned to his office. Stephen had been carried off to Dr. Rami's healthier table to drink gaseous water from a sulphurous spring, and Cape Sissier had turned purple against the now violet sea. Crickets filled the air with a warm, continuous, omnipresent chirr. Both Jack and Christy Valliere had drunk a great deal. They were now telling one another about their professional difficulties, and each was astonished that the other had reason to complain. Christy Valliere, too, was caught on the promotion ladder, for although he was a capitaine de vaisseau, very like a post-captain, there was no proper sense of seniority in the French Navy. Dirty, underhand intrigue everywhere, political adventurers succeeding, real seamen thrust to the wall. He did not express himself directly, but Jack knew from their conversations a year ago, and from the indiscretions of his English Christie cousins, that his friend was but a lukewarm Republican, detested the upstart Bonaparte's vulgarity and total ignorance of the sea service, would have liked a constitutional liberal monarchy, and was uneasy in his skin. A man devoted to his navy, and of course to France, but unhappy in his rulers. Long ago he had spoken in a remarkably informed and perceptive way about the case of Irish officers in the Royal Navy, and the moral dilemma of conflicting loyalties. But at this moment, although four sorts of wine and two of brandy had brought him handsomely into the area of indiscretion, he was solely concerned with his own immediate problems. "For you, it is perfectly simple," he said. "You will assemble your interest, your friends, and the lords and sirs of your acquaintance, and eventually, with your parliamentary elections, there will be a change of ministry, and your evident merits will be recognised. But what is the case with us? Republican interest, royalist influence, Catholic interest, Freemason interest, consular, or what they tell me will soon be imperial interest, all cutting one across another, foul whores. We might as well finish this bottle. You know," he said after a pause, "I am so tired of sitting on my arse in an office. The only hope, the only solution is..." His voice died away. "I suppose it would be wicked to pray for war," said Jack, whose mind had followed exactly the same course. "But, oh, to be afloat!" "Oh, very wicked, no doubt. Particularly as the only worthwhile war would have to be against the nation we like best. For the Dutch and Spaniards are no match for us now. It makes me stare every time I think of it, how well the Spaniards build. Beautiful, beautiful great ships. And how strangely they handle them. At the Battle of St. Vincent..." "It is all the fault of their admiralty," cried Christy Palliere. "All admiralties are the same. I swear on the head of my mother that our admiralty..." A messenger brought him up short on the brink of high treason. He excused himself, stepped aside, and read the note. He read it twice, clearing the fumes of brandy from his head, sobering fast. He was a massive, bear-like man, not as tall as Jack, but stouter, and he could stand his drink. Broad, somewhat round-shouldered, with very kind brown eyes. Kind, but not foolish. And when he came back to the table carrying a pot of coffee, they were hard and piercing. He hesitated for some time, sipping the coffee before he spoke. "All navies have these problems," he said slowly. "My colleague who looks after them here is on leave. I take his place. Here I have a description of a man in a black coat with a telescope on Mount Farran this morning, looking at our installations. Medium height, slim, pale eyes, bob wig, grey breeches, speaks French with a southern accent. He has also been talking to a Barcelona merchant, a curious fellow with two feluccas in the das." "Why," cried Jack, That must certainly be Stephen Maturin. I've no doubt of it. He has a telescope. One of Dolan's very best glasses. I'm sure he was up there on Farron this morning before I was out of bed, gazing about for his precious birds. He mentioned some monstrous rare pipit or titmouse that lives there. I wonder, laughing heartily, he didn't go up to the fort and beg for the use of their big artillery instruments. Oh, no, he's the simplest fellow in the world, I give you my word of honour. Unspeakably learned, knows every bug and beetle in the universe and will have your leg off in an instant, but he shouldn't be allowed out alone. And as for naval installations, he really can't tell port from starboard, a bonnet from a drabbler, though I've explained 1,000 times that he does try to apply himself, poor fellow. I'm sure it must be he, from what you tell me about his speaking to the Barcelona merchant. And in that language, I dare say. He lived in those parts for years and speaks their lingo like a native. We're on our way down there now to a property he has. And as soon as he's been across to Porquerolles to see some curious shrub that grows on the island and nowhere else, we shall move on. He laughed, his big voice full of intense amusement. To think of poor good old Stephen being laid by the heels for a spy. There was no possibility of resisting his transparent good faith. Christy Pellier's eyes softened. He smiled with relief and said, "So you will vouch for him then, upon your honour?" "My hand upon my heart," said Jack, placing it there. "My dear sir, surely your men must be a very simple crew to go round suspecting Stephen Maturin." "That is the trouble," said Christy Valier. "Many of them are stupid. But that is not the worst of it. There are other services. The gendarmerie, Fouché's men, and all those land people, as you know. And some of them are no wiser. So pray tell your friend to be more discreet. And listen, my dear Aubrey," he said in a low, significant voice. "It might be as well if you did not cross to Porquerolles, but pressed on to Spain." "Because of the heat?" asked Jack.
Christy Pellier shrugged. "If you like," he said, "I say no more."
He took a turn up and down the terrace, ordered a fresh bottle, and returned to Jack. "And so you saw my cousins in Bath," he said in quite another conversational tone. "Yes, yes, I did myself the honour of calling at Laura Place the first time I was there, and they very kindly asked me to drink tea with them. They were all at home, Mrs. Christy, Miss Susan, Madame de Aguilière, and Tom. Charming people, so friendly and welcoming. We talked about you a great deal, and they hoped you might come over soon. Sent everything proper, of course, kindest regards, kisses, I believe, from the girls. The second time they invited me to a ramble and a picnic, but unhappily I was bespoke. I was in Bath twice."
"What did you think of Polly?"
"Oh, a dear girl, full of fun and so kind to your old aunt, I believe. And how she rattled away in French. I said several things myself, which she understood straight away, and relayed to the old lady, repeating my signals, as it were."
"She is a dear child," said her cousin. "And believe me," he said very seriously, "that girl can cook. Her coq au vin, her sole Normande. And she has a deep comprehension of the English pudding. That strawberry jam was hers. A wonderful housekeeper. She has a modest little fortune, too," he added, looking abstractedly at a tartan working into the port.
"Oh, dear Lord," cried Jack with a vehemence that made Christy Pellier look round with alarm. "Dear Lord, for the moment I almost forgot. Shall I tell you why I was in Bath?"
"Do, I beg."
"It is between ourselves."
Christy Pellier nodded.
"By God, I'm so wretched about it. It was only that splendid dinner of yours that put it out of my mind these last 2 hours. Otherwise, it's been with me ever since I left England. There was a girl, do you see, that I'd met in Sussex, neighbours. And when I had a bad time in the Admiralty Court with my neutrals, her mother took her down there, no longer approving of the connection. There was very nearly an understanding between us before then, but somehow I never quite clinched it. Christ, what a fool I was. So I saw her in Bath, but could never come to close quarters. I believe she didn't quite like some little attentions I'd paid her cousin.
Innocent attentions?
Well, yes, really. Though I dare say they might have been misinterpreted. An astonishingly lovely girl, or rather woman. Been married once, husband knocked on the head in India, with a splendid dash and courage. And then, while I was eating my heart out between the Admiralty and the moneylenders in the city, I learnt that some fellow had made her an offer of marriage. It was spoken of everywhere as a settled thing. I cannot tell you how it hurt me. And this other girl, the one who stayed in Sussex, was so kind and sympathetic and so very beautiful too that I... Well, you understand me. But, however, as soon as I thought things were going along capitally with her and that we were very close friends, she pulled me up as though I'd run into a boom and asked me who the devil I thought I was. I'd lost all my money by then, as you know, so, upon my word, I could scarcely tell what to answer, particularly as I had begun to make out that maybe she was attached to my best friend and perhaps the other way too, you follow me? I wasn't quite sure, but it looked damnably like it, above all when they parted. But I was so infernally hooked. Couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. And sometimes she was charming to me again. So I committed myself pretty far, partly out of pique, do you see? Oh, God damn it all! If only... And then on top of it all there comes a letter from the first girl.
A letter to you? Cried Christy Palliere.
But this was not an intrigue, as I understand you.
As innocent as the day. Not as much as... Well, hardly so much as a kiss.
It was a surprising thing, was it not? But it was in England, you know, not in France, and things are rather different there. Even so, it was astonishing, but such a sweet, modest letter, just to say that the whole thing about the marriage was so much goddamn stuff. It reached me the very day I left the country.
Why, then, everything is perfect, surely. It is in a serious young woman and a vowel. What more could you ask?
Why, said Jack, with so wretched a look that Christy Palliere, who had hitherto thought him a muff to mind having two young women at once, felt a wound in his heart. He patted Jack's arm to comfort him.
Why, there is this other one, don't you see?
Said Jack.
In honour, I'm pretty well committed to her.
Although it's not the same sort of feeling at all. To say nothing of my friend.
Stephen and Dr. Ramy were closeted in a book-blind study. The great herbal that had been one of the subjects of their correspondence for the past year and more lay open on the table, with a high-detailed map of the new Spanish defences of Port Mahon folded into it. Dr. Ramy had just come from Minorca, his native island, and he had brought several documents for Stephen, for he was his most important contact with the Catalan autonomists. These papers, read and committed to memory, were now crushed black ashes in the fireplace, and the two men had moved on to the subject of humanity at large, man's general unfitness for life as it is lived.
"This is particularly the case with sailors," said Stephen. "I have watched them attentively and find that they are more unsuited for life, as it is ordinarily understood, than men of any other calling whatsoever. I propose the following reason for this. The sailor at sea, his proper element, lives in the present. There is nothing he can do about the past at all. And, having regard to the uncertainty of the omnipotent ocean and the weather, very little about the future. This, I may say in passing, accounts for the common tar's improvidence. The officers spend their lives fighting against this attitude on the part of the men, persuading them to tighten ropes, to belay, and so on, against a vast series of contingencies.
But the officers, being as seaborne as the rest, do their task with a half conviction. From this arises uneasiness of mind, and hence the vagaries of those in authority. Sailors will provide against a storm tomorrow, or even in a fortnight's time, but for them the remoter possibilities are academic, unreal. They live in the present, I say, and basing itself upon this, my mind offers a partially formed conjecture. I should value your reflections upon it. My lights are yours, for what they may be worth, said Dr. Rami, leaning back and watching him with a dry, sharp, intelligent black eye. Though, as you know, I am an enemy to speculation. Let us take the whole range of disorders that have their origin in the mind. The disordered or the merely idle mind. False pregnancies. Many hysterias. Palpitations. Dyspepsias. Eczematous affectations. Some forms of impotence. And many more that will occur to you at once. Now, as far as my limited experience goes, these we do not find aboard ship. You agree, my dear colleague? Dr. Rami pursed his lips and said, with reservations, I believe I may venture to say that I am tempted to do so. I do not commit myself, however. Now, let us turn our honest tar ashore, where he is compelled to live not in the present but in the future, with reference to futurity. All joys, benefits, prosperities to be hoped for, looked forward to, the subject of anxious thought directed towards next month, next year, nay, the next generation. No slops provided by the purser, no food perpetually served out at stated intervals. And what do we find? Pox, drunkenness, bestial dissolution of all moral principle, gross overeating, the liver ruined in 10 days' time. Certainly, certainly, but more than that, we find not indeed false pregnancies, but everything short of them, anxiety, hypochondria, displacency, melancholia, costive delicate stomachs, the ills of the city merchant increased tenfold. I have a particularly interesting subject who was in the most robust health at sea, Hygeia's darling, in spite of every kind of excess and of the most untoward circumstances. A short while on land with household cares, matrimonial fancies, always in the future, observe, and we have a loss of 11 pounds weight, a retention of the urine, black, compact, meagre stools, an obstinate eczema. And for you, all this is the effect of solid earth beneath the subject's feet, no more? Stephen held up his hands. It is the fetus of a thought, but I cherish it. You speak of loss of weight, but I find that you yourself are thin, nay, cadaverous, if I may speak as one physician to another. You have a very ill breath. Your hair, already meagre 2 years ago, is now extremely sparse. You belch frequently. Your eyes are hollow and dim. This is not merely your ill-considered use of tobacco, a noxious substance that should be prohibited by government, and of laudanum. I should very much like to see your excrement. You shall, my dear sir, you shall. But I must leave you now. You will not forget my tincture. I shall abandon it entirely once I am in Lerida, but until then, it is necessary to me. You shall have it. And, said Dr. Rami with a veiled look, it is possible that I may send you a note of the first importance at the same time. I shall not know for some hours yet. If I do, it will be in System 3. But pray let me feel your pulse before you go. Reedy. Intermittent, my friend. Just as I thought. What did he mean by that? Said Stephen, referring not to the pulse but to the hypothetical note, and thinking again with some regret of the simplicity of his dealings with plain mercenary agents. Their motives were so clear, their loyalties were to their persons and their purse. the complexities of the entirely honest men, their sudden reticences, the interplay of conflicting loyalties, the personal sense of humour made him feel old and tired. "Why, Stephen, here you are at last," cried Jack, starting straight out of his sleep. "I sat talking with Christy Pallier. I hope you didn't wait for me." The subject of their conversation flooded his mind and put out its gaiety. But having gazed at the floor for a moment, he looked up with at least an expression of cheerfulness and said, "You were very nearly taken up for a spy this morning." Stephen stopped in his movement towards the desk and stood motionless, unnaturally poised. "How I laughed when Christy Pallier read me out your description, looking uncomfortable and prodigious grave. But I assured him of my sacred honour that you were looking for your double-headed eagles, and he was quite satisfied. He made an odd remark, by the way. Said, was he in our shoes, he should push on for Spain and not go to Porquerolles."
Aye, did he so?" said Stephen mildly. "Go back to sleep now, my dear. I conceive he wouldn't choose to traverse the street to see Euphorbia Priestends, let alone cross an arm of the sea. I have a few notes to write, but I shall not disturb you. Go to sleep. We have a long day ahead of us."
Some hours later, in the first grey light, Jack awoke to a faint scratching on the door. His waking mind stated that this was a rat in the bread room, but his body instantly contradicted it. Sleeping or awake, his body knew whether it was afloat or not. At no time was it ever unaware of the continual shift and heave of the sea, or of the unnatural stability of the land. He opened his eyes and saw Stephen rise from his guttering candle, open the door, receive a bottle and a folded note. He went back to his table, opened the note, slowly deciphered it, burnt both scraps of paper in the candle flame. Without turning round, he said, "Jack, you're awake, I believe?" "Yes, these last 5 minutes." "Good morning to you, Stephen. Is it going to be hot?" "It is." "And a good morning to you, my dear." "Listen," he said, sinking his voice to no more than a whisper. "And do not call out or agitate yourself. Do you hear me now?"
"Yes."
"War will be declared tomorrow. Bonaparte is seizing all British subjects." In the narrow band of shade under the northern wall of Carcassonne, a compassionate gendarme halted his convoy of English prisoners. Seamen from detained and captured ships, for the most part. A few officers who had been caught by the declaration of war, but some civilians, too. Travelling gentlemen, servants, grooms and tradesmen. Since, for the first time in civilised warfare, Bonaparte had ordered the arrest of every British subject. They were hot, disconsolate and weary. Their bundles had been soaked in a thunderstorm, and at first they hadn't even the spirit to spread them out in the sun, let alone to take notice of the dilapidated splendour of walls and turrets behind, the view of the new town and the river before them, or even the bear and its leader in the shadow of the next tower but one. But presently the word of the arrival of the convoy spread, and the crowd that had hurried out of the old town to stare was joined by market women from over the bridge, bringing fruit, wine, bread, honey, sausages, pâté and goat cheeses wrapped in fresh green leaves. Most of the prisoners still had some money. This was only the beginning of their march to the far northeast. And when they'd cooled a little, eaten and drunk, they put their clothes to dry and began to look about them. "What, oh, the bear!" cried a sailor, quite happy now, with a quart of wine under his brass-buckled belt. "Can he dance, mate?" The bear leader, an ill-looking brute with a patch over one eye and a fortnight's beard, took no notice. But the sailor was not to be put off by the sullenness of foreigners, and he was soon joined by an insistent group of friends, for he was the most popular and influential member of the crew of the Pink Chastity, a merchantman that had had the unlucky idea of putting into set for water the day war was declared. One or two of them began shying stones at the great hairy mass to wake it up, or at least to have the pleasure of seeing it move. "Avast the stone-throwing!" cried the sailor, his cheerful face clouding. "You don't want to go a-teasing of bears, Cully. Remember Elisha. There's nothing so unlucky as teasing a bear." "You've been a bear-baiting, George, you know you have," said a shipmate, tossing his stone up and down, not to have the air of abandoning it. "We've been to Hockley together."
"Bear-baiting is different," said George. "The bears at Hockley is willing. This bear ain't. I dare say it's hot. Bears is Greenland creatures."
The bear certainly looked hot. It was stretched out on what little grass it could find, strangely prostrate. But the clamour had spread. Crews of other ships wanted to see it dance. And after some time the bear leader came up and gave them to understand that the animal was indisposed. Could only perform at night. "Im av airy coat, mister. Im ate up whole goat for im dinner, im bellyache."
"Why, shipmates, there you are, just as I said," cried George. "How do you like dancing in a fucking great fur pelisse in this fucking sun?"
Events had escaped from George's control, however. An English sea officer, wishing to impress the lady with whom he was travelling, had spoken to the sergeant of gendarmerie, and now the sergeant whistled to the master of the bear.
"Papers," he said. "A Spanish passport, eh? A very greasy passport, too, my friend. Do you sleep with your bear? Joan Margal, born in... what's this place?"
"Lerida, monsieur le sergent," said the man, with the cringing humility of the poor.
"Lerida. Profession bear leader, eh bien. A lead bear knows how to dance, that's logic. I have to have proof. It is my duty to see the bear perform."
"Oh, certainly, monsieur le sergent, at once. But the gentleman will not expect too much from Flora. She is a female bear, and..."
He whispered in the gendarme's ear. "Ha, ha! Just so," said the gendarme. "Well, just a pace or two, to satisfy my sense of duty."
Dragged up by its chain and beaten by its leader till the dust flew from its shaggy side, the bear shuffled forward. The man took a little pipe from his bosom and played it with one hand while he held the chain with the other. He hoisted the bear onto its hind legs, where it stood swaying amidst a murmur of disapprobation from the sailors.
"Crow buggers, these foreigners," said George. "Look at his poor nose with a fucking great ring." "English gents," said the man with an ingratiating leer. "Hornpipe."
He played a recognisable hornpipe, and the bear staggered through a few of the steps, crossing its arms, before sitting down again. Trumpets sounded from the citadel behind the walls. The guard and the Narbonne gate changed, and the sergeant began to bawl,
en route, les prisonniers!"
With avid and shamelessly persistent busyness, the bear leader hurried up and down the line.
"Remember the bear, gents, remember the bear. N'oubliez pas l'eau, messieurs dames."
Silence. The convoy's dust settled on the empty road. The inhabitants of Carcassonne all went to sleep. Even the small boys who had been dropping mortar and clods of earth from the battlements onto the bear disappeared. Silence at last, and the chink of coins.
2 livres 4 sous, said the bear leader. 1 maravedi, 2 levantine coins of whose exact provenance I am uncertain, a Scotch groat.
When one sea officer's to be roasted, there's always another at hand to turn the spit, said the bear.
It's an old service proverb. I hope to God I have that fornicating young sod under my command one day. I'll make him dance a hornpipe. Ooh, such a hornpipe. Stephen, prop my jaws open a little more, will you?
I think I shall die in 5 minutes if you don't. Couldn't we creep into a field and take it off?
No, said Stephen, but I shall lead you to an inn as soon as the market has cleared, and lodge you in a cool, damp cellar for the afternoon. I must also get you a collar to enable you to breathe. We must reach Coiza by dawn. The white road winding, winding up and up the French side of the Pyrenees. The afternoon sun, the June sun now, beating straight down on the dusty slope. The bear and its leader plodding on. Scorned by carts, feared by horses, they had already walked 350 miles, taking a zigzag route to avoid most large towns and the dangerous zone of the coast, and to stay 2 nights in houses belonging to shore friends. Stephen was leading the bear by the paw, for Jack couldn't see below his muzzle when his head was on, and in his other hand he had the broad, spiked collar that covered the hole through which Jack breathed. He was obliged to put it on for the best part of the day, however, for although this was a remote valley, there were houses every few hundred yards, hamlets not 3 or 4 miles apart, and fools that kept accompanying them on their way. Was it a wise bear? How much did it eat a week? Was it ever wicked? Could he buckle the two ends of his mouth by exhibiting it? And the nearer they came to the mountains, the more anecdotes of the bears that had been heard of, actually seen and even killed. Bears, wolves, smugglers and mountain bandits, the Trabuqueres and the Migueletes, communicative fools, cheerful villagers, all eager for a treat, and dogs. Every hamlet, every farmhouse had its swarm of dogs that came out amazed, howling, yapping and barking, haunting the bear's heels, sometimes as far as the next vile swarm, for the dogs, if not the men, knew that there was something unnatural in the bear.
"It will not be long now," said Stephen. "At the far end, beyond the trees, I can see the turning of the main Le Pertu road. You can lie in the wood while I walk to the village to find out what is afoot. Should you like to sit down for a moment on this milestone? There's water in the ditch and you could soak your feet."
"Oh, I don't mind it," said Jack, staggering as Stephen altered the rhythm of his walk to peer into the ditch. "And I dare not soak them again in any case."
The massive, hairy shape writhed a little, a mechanical attempt at seeing its tattered buttocks, legs and lower paws, dog-lacerated. "The wood is not very far off, I dare say."
"Oh, not above an hour or so. It is a beech wood with an old marl pit, and you may, I do not assert it, but I say you may, see the purple helleborine growing there."
Lying in the deep, cool fern with his collar off, Jack felt the sweat still coursing down his chest, and the movement of ants, ticks, unidentified insects invading him. He smelt his own unwashed reek and the moist stench of the skin, imperfectly preserved in turpentine, but he minded none of it. He was too far gone to do anything but lie in the complete relaxation of utter weariness. It had, of course, been impossible to disguise him. A 6-foot, yellow-haired Englishman would have stood out like a steeple in the south of France. A France alive with people tracking fugitives of one kind or another, foreign and domestic. But the price for this attempt was beyond anything he had believed possible. The torment of the ill-fitting, chafing hide, the incessantly repeated small rasping wounds, the ooze of blood, the flayed soles of his feet attached to the fur by court plaster, the heat, the suffocation, the vile uncleanliness had reached what he had thought the unendurable point 10 days, 200 miles ago, in the torrid waste of the Côte du Palin. Was this attempt going to succeed? At the bottom of his heart he'd never doubted it to begin with. So long as he did his part, barring some act of God or unaccountable misfortune, neither he nor Stephen Maturin would pass the rest of the war as prisoners,
cut off from all possibility of service, promotion, a lucky cruise, cut off from Sophia, cut off indeed from Diana. A long war he made no doubt, for Bonaparte was strong. Jack had been astonished by the state of forwardness of everything he'd seen in Toulon. 3 ships of the line almost ready for launching, a huge quantity of stores, unexampled zeal. Any man bred to the sea, any born sailor, could tell within an hour of being aboard whether a ship was an efficient, happy, coordinated whole. It was the same with a naval port. And in Toulon his quick, professional eye had seen a great machine running very fast, very smoothly. France was strong. France owned the fine Dutch navy, controlled huge areas of Western Europe. England was weak and alone. No allies left at all, as far as he could tell from the fragmentary partial news they'd picked up. Certainly the Royal Navy was weak, he had no doubt of that at all. St. Vincent had tried to reform the dockyards rather than build ships, and now there were fewer that could stand in the line of battle than there had been in 93, in spite of all the building and all the captures during the 10 years of war. And that again was a reason, quite apart from the obligations of the treaty, why Spain should come in on the side of France. Another reason why they should find the frontier closed and Stephen's refuge lost to them, the attempt a failure after all. Had Spain declared? For the last 2 or 3 days, they had been in the Roussillon, in French Catalonia, and he hadn't been able to understand anything that Stephen and the peasants said to one another. Stephen was strangely reticent these days. Jack had supposed he knew him through and through in the old uncomplicated times, and he loved all he knew. But now there were new depths, an underlying hard ruthlessness, an unexpected maturin. And Jack was quite out of his depth. Stephen had gone on leaving him. Stephen had a passport into Spain, could move about there, war or no. Jack's mind darkened still further, and thoughts he dared not formulate came welling up, an ugly swarm. "Dear God," he said at last, twisting his head from side to side, "could I have sweated all my courage out? Courage gone and generosity with it?" He'd seen courage go. Men run down hatchways in battle, officers cower behind the capstan. He and Stephen had talked about it. Was courage a fixed, permanent quality? An expendable substance, each man having just so much, with a possible end in sight? Stephen had put forward views on courage, varying and relative, dependent upon diet, circumstances, the functioning of the bowels, the costive, frequently timid, upon use, upon physical and spiritual freshness or exhaustion, the aged proverbially cautious, courage not an entity, but to be regarded as belonging to different, though related, systems, moral, physical, sexual, courage in brutes, in the castrated, complete integrity, unqualified courage or puerile fiction jealousy, its effect upon courage, Stoics, the satiates vitae, and the supreme courage of indifference. 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 The tune that Stephen always played on his bear leader's pipe began to run through his head, mingling with Stephen's voice and half-remembered instances of courage from Plutarch, Nicholas of Pisa, and Boethius. A curious little air with archaic intervals, limited to what 4 fingers and overblowing could do, but subtle, complicated. The roaring of a little girl in a white pinafore woke him. She and some unseen friend were looking for the summer mushrooms that were found in this wood, and she had come upon a fungoid growth. "Ramon!" she bellowed, and the hollow echoed with the sound. "Ramon! Ramon! Ramon! Come and see what I've found! Come and see what I've found! Come and see..." On and on and on. She was turned 3 quarters from him.
But presently, since her companion didn't answer, she pivoted, directing her strong voice to the different quarters of the wood. Jack had already shrunk as far as he could, and now, as the child's face veered towards him, he closed his eyes in case she should sense their savage glare. His mind was now all alive. No trace of indifference now, but a passionate desire to succeed in this immediate step, to carry the whole undertaking through, come hell or high water. Frighten the little beast, and you'll have a band of armed peasants round the wood in 5 minutes. Slip away, and you lose Stephen. Out of touch, and all our papers sewed inside the skin. The possibilities came racing one after another, and no solution. Come. Come, child, said Stephen. You will spoil your voice if you call out so. What have you there?
It is a satanic boletus. You must not eat the satanic boletus, my dear. See how it turns blue when I break it with a twig. That is the devil blushing.
But here we have a parasol. You may certainly eat the parasol. Have you seen my bear? I left him in the wood when I went to see Enhome. He was sadly fatigued. Bears cannot stand the sun. Enhome is my godfather's uncle, said the child. My godfather is Zanpere. What is the name of your bear?
Flora, said Stephen, and called, Flora!
You said him just now,
said the child with a frown, and began to roar, Flora! 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 Flora!
Oh, Mother of God, what a huge great bear!
She put a hand in Stephen's and murmured,
Ay, my, in the face of God, what a bear!
But her courage returned, and she set to bellowing, Ramon! 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 Come and see my bear!
Goodbye, poppets, said Stephen in time. May God go with you. And waving still to the little figures, he said, I have firm news at last, mixed news. Spain has not declared war, but the Mediterranean ports are closed to English ships. We must go down to Gibraltar.
What about the frontier?
Stephen pursed his lips. The village is filled with police and soldiers. Two intelligence men are in charge, searching everything. They've arrested one English agent.
How do you know?
The priest who confessed him told me. But should I've never thought of the road itself. I know, I did know, another way. Stand over more this way. The pink roof, and behind it a peak, and to the right of that, beyond the forest, a bare mountain. That is the frontier, Joy. And in the dip there is a pass, a path, down to the Cassins and Cantaloupes. We will slip across the road after dusk and be there at dawn.
May I take off the skin?
You may not. I regret it extremely, Jack, but I do not know the path well. There are patrols out, not only for the smugglers, but for the fugitives, and we may blunder into one or even two. It is a smuggler's path, a dangerous path indeed, for while the French may shoot you for walking upon it as a man, the smugglers may do the same for looking like a bear, but the second is the proper choice. Your smuggler is open to reason, and your patrol is not. Half an hour in the bushes by the road, waiting for the long, slow train of a battery to pass by. The guns, wagons, camp followers. Several coaches, one pulled by 8 mules in crimson harness, some isolated horsemen. For now that they could see the frontier line, their caution grew to superstitious lengths. Half an hour, and then across to the cart track, up to Saint-Jean-de-l'Albert. Up and up, the moon clearing the forest ahead of them after the first hour. And with the coming of the moon, the first breaths of a sirocco from the Spanish plains, a waft from an opened oven door. Up
and still up. After the last barn, the track dwindled to a ribbon, and they had to walk in single file. Jack saw Stephen's monstrous bundle, a dark shape no more, moving steadily a pace or two in front of them, and something like hatred glowed around his stomach. He reasoned, "The pack is heavy. It weighs 50 or 60 pounds, all our possessions. He too has been going on all these days, never a murmur. The straps ring his back and shoulders, a bloody welt on either side." But the unwavering determination of that dim form moving steadily on and on, effortlessly it seemed, always too fast and never pausing, the impossibility of keeping up, of forcing himself another 100 yards, and the equal impossibility of calling for a rest, drowned his reason, leaving only the dull fire of resentment. The path meandered, branching and sometimes disappearing among huge, ancient, widespread beeches, their trunks silver in the moon. And at last Stephen stopped. Jack blundered into him, stood still, and felt a hand gripping him hard through the skin. Stephen guided him into the black velvet shadow of a fallen tree. Over the soughing of the wind, he heard a repeated metallic sound, and as he recognised the regular beat, a patrol making too much noise, all notion of the unbreathable air and the intolerable state of his body left him. Low voices now and then, a cough, still the clink, clink, clink of someone's musket against a buckle, and presently the soldiers passed within 20 yards of them, moving down the mountainside. The same strong hand pulling him, and they were on the path again. Always this eternal climb. Sometimes across the leaf-filled bed of a stream, sometimes up an open slope so steep that it was hands and knees. And the Sirocco. Can this be real, he wondered? Must it go on forever? The beech trees gave way to pines. Pine needles underfoot. Oh, the pain! Endless pines on an endless mountain, their roaring tops bowing northwards in the wind. The shape in front had stopped, muttering, "It should be about here, the second fork. There was a charcoal burner's lay. An uprooted larch, bees in the hollow trunk." Jack closed his eyes for a great swimming pause, a respite. And when he opened them again, he saw that the sky ahead was lightening. Behind them, the moon had sunk into a haze, far down in the deep-veiled, complicated valleys. The pines. Then, suddenly, no more pines. A few stunted bushes, heather, and the open turf. They were on the upper edge of the forest. A forest ruled off sharp as though by a line. And they stood, silently looking out. After 2 or 3 minutes, right up there in the eye of the wind, Jack saw a movement. Leaning to Stephen, he said, "Dog?" Soldiers who had had the sense to bring a dog? Loss. Dead failure after all this. Stephen took his head, and whispering right into the hairy ear, he said, "Wolf. A young female wolf." Still, Stephen waited, searching the bushes, the bare rocks, from the far left to the far right, before he walked out, paced over the short grass to a stone set on the very top of the slope, a squared stone, with a red-painted cross cut into it. "Jack," said he, leading him beyond the boundary mark, "I bid you welcome to my land. We are in Spain. That is my house below. We are at home. Come, let me get your head off. Now you can breathe, my poor friend. There are two springs under the brow of the hill by those chestnuts where you can wash and take off the skin. How I rejoice at the sight of that wolf. Look, here's her dung, quite fresh. No doubt this is a wolf's pissing post. Like all the dogs, they have their regular... Jack sat heavily on the stone, gasping inwards, filling his starved lungs. Some reality other than general suffering returned. Wolf's pissing post, oh, yes. In front of him the ground fell suddenly, almost a precipice. 2,000 feet below, there was Spanish Catalonia, spread out in the morning light. A high-towered castle just below them, on a jutting rock. A lobbed stone would reach it. The Pyrenees folded away and away in long fingers to the plain. Square, distant fields, vineyards green, a shining river winding left-handed towards the great sweep of the sea, the Bay of Rosas, with Capcreus at the far northern end. Home water. And now the hot wind smelt of salt. "I'm happy you were pleased with your wolf," he said at last, in a sleepwalker's voice. They are uncommon rare, I dare say. "Not at all, my dear. We have them by the score. Can never leave the sheep by night. No, her presence means we are alone. That is why I rejoice. I rejoice! Even so, I think we should go down to the spring. It is under the chestnuts. Those chestnuts not 2 minutes down. That wolfess may be a fool. See her now moving among the junipers? And I shouldn't wish to fail just when we've succeeded. Some chance cross-patrol. Douanier rather than soldiers. Some zealous sergeant with a carabine. Can you get up? God help me, I hardly can. The spring... Jack wallowing in it, cold water and grit sweeping off the crass, the stream running filthy but coming fresh and fresh straight from the rock. Jack luxuriating, drying in the wind, plunging again and again. His body was dead white where it was not cruelly galled, bitten, rasped. His colourless face puffy, sweat-swollen, corpse-like, a tangled yellow beard covering his mouth. His eyes were red and pustulant, but there was life in them, brilliant delight, blazing through the physical distress. "You have lost between 3 and 4 stone, observed Stephen, appraising his loins and belly. "I'm sure you're right," said Jack, "and 9 parts of it is in this vile skin, a good 3 stone of human grease." He kicked the limp bear with his bleeding foot, damned it once or twice for a son of a bitch, and observed he must take the papers out before setting it alight. "How it'll stink! How it does stink, by God! Just hand me along the scissors, Stephen, pray." "The bear may serve again," said Stephen. "Let's roll it up and thrust it under the bush. I will send for it from the house." "Is the house a great way off?" "Why, no," said Stephen, pointing to the castle. "It's just there below us, 1,000 feet or so, to the right of the White Scar, the marble quarry. Though I'm afraid it'll take us an hour to get there. An hour to breakfast."
"Is that castle yours, Stephen?"
"It is. And this is my sheep walk. What is more," he said, looking sharply at the cowpats, "I believe those French dogs from La Vaille have been sending their cattle over to eat my grass.